Welcome to El Paso Food Voices. I'm Mary Diria Barca. Today's episode focuses on food and the senses. This episode forms part of a special feature of El Paso Food Voices on culinary heritage and culinary kinship. This episode comes from a class-based project that my students and I have done together in a graduate seminar titled Mapping Culinary Narratives. My students and I have created this project that we are calling an audio documentary focusing on these two concepts of culinary heritage and culinary kinship. Today, they're going to be speaking about food in the senses in relationship to culinary heritage and kinship. So I would like to welcome these three students of mine, Marisa, Fernanda, and Tony. They're going to be sharing what they have learned in class about this topic. So welcome to El Paso Food Voices.
Thank you very much. I'm Marisa Bond. I am a PhD student in rhetoric and writing studies here at the University of El Paso, Texas, better known as UTEP.
I am Fernanda Estrada. I am a master's degree student here at UTEP as well.
And I'm Tony. I am a master's of American literature at UTEP as well.
Excellent. And so we're all coming here from three very different disciplines, but I think that we find that those overlap in a really interesting way to give us some different perspectives on the ways that food and the senses work together. So in thinking about that, as we launch into the idea of food and the senses, there is one dominant sense that we think of in relationship with food, obviously, it's taste. But there is a lot more that takes place in our relationship with food and how we interact with that bodily. And I'd like to turn this over to a soundbite from Yolanda Leva in the El Paso Food Voices blog, when she is describing cooking with her grandson and the sensory experiences of that.
I was teaching him once how to roast corn on a comal, and I had him put his hand on the corn, and you could feel it transforming. You could feel the heat affecting it. And he was so surprised that he could feel the corn changing. So he understands that food is something that you don't just taste, you know, but I teach him smell it. I teach him feel it when it's cooking, you know, and also listen, because we could hear the corn making little noises as it was roasting.
I really love that quote because I think it reminds us, and you can hear it in her voice too, the way she slows down and encourages us to think about what all the senses are that are going into what we're eating, into the creation of food, into the experience of making food together, how it is, taste is at the end of it, but there's so much about the way that you feel, the way that you smell things, the sounds that sort of emerge from it. So I'd like to start by asking y'all, which sense, when activated, makes you immediately hungry? Like for me, I think about the crisp crackle sound of cold butter hitting the hot surface of a cast iron pan, you know? And it makes that sizzle and that sudden pop of buttery smell in your nostrils that immediately makes me ready for whatever's coming. What about you?
That's a great question, Marisa. I think for me it would be just sight. When you see the food, you already know what it's going to taste like. You already know what it's going to feel like. You already know what it's going to look like. So, I mean, just by looking at it, you can basically already taste it, I think. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, whenever you see a Papa John's commercial and you already know what the Papa John's is going to taste like because you've had it before.
Yeah, and I think you know, seeing is really important, but I also think that sound is, honestly, to me, the most important. There's a certain experience that one has when you walk into a restaurant and all you hear is, you know, people talking, or you hear the clanging of pans, plates, the turning on of a stove, or even the fajitas that are sizzling on the way to another table because you forgot to order them.
I know, every time.
I think that's like the most, like, visceral reactions to hear that and just, you know, it's time to eat. And I think that's a great experience for me.
You're ready for, got me ready for fajitas right now. And I think what's important about that, though, is that shows how much the environment is part of our sensory experience as well. And this relates to an article that we'd actually read by Meredita Vaca and Joshua Colby about how food memory can operate as a form of a sense. The idea that it is that when we're eating something, it can compound not only our physical senses, but also compress other senses that we have. The sense of time, for instance, how when we're eating a meal, it sort of layers on all of the meals that we've had in the past and our hopes of the meals in the future. And it also allows us to think about the whole embodied experience of where we are as being part of what creates our culinary experiences, our culinary moments that matter to us. And that leads me into thinking about what are the culinary moments that matter? What are the environments that start to create this sensory experience that is so immersive? And Fernanda, I think that this would be a good time to introduce your soundbite, which is from the 2022 film The Menu, directed by Mark Mylod, I believe. So can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Of course, yeah. So basically, the main character, he's a chef. He has professionals working and staying, in the kitchen just to be ready up at 5 a.m, grow the food, process the food, make it. And he's basically bringing in very wealthy people who he knows are, just somewhat unappreciative of what he has to offer, and it's almost like a test that he does with the food. So we'll hear that in the soundbite.
All right, I have not seen this one yet, but now I have to. But all right, let's go ahead and take a listen to that clip.
Do not eat. Taste. Savor. Relish. Consider every morsel that you place inside your mouth. Be mindful, but do not eat. Our menu is too precious for that. And look around you. Here we are, on this island. Accept all of it.
Yeah, so just to elaborate a little bit more on that. You can always make an assumption of what he means by do not eat. And so mine was basically, he wasn't telling them not to eat the food. He was telling them to, while eating it, savor it and appreciate it and look around them and be mindful of those things they've spent so much money on, and to make a memory out of that. And caption everything going on around them, not just the dish.
Mm. And I appreciate how that highlights that the culinary experience, the culinary memories, as being something that is tied to a dish, but not only part of that. Can you tell us something about a culinary experience that for you has felt like a full experience, or what to you makes a culinary experience worth having?
Yeah, I think for me, and I'm going to play a bit of a devil's advocate in this one, because I feel like a lot of people would normally say that their memories are around people, around a fabulous environment or such, maybe having dinner at a cruise or with their significant other or their families or friends. Mine has always just kind of been the moments that I've gotten by myself. Mm-hmm. Just the experience of taking a book and knowing that I'm not being timed or rushed. That's something that matters to me when I'm, in a restaurant or even in my own home, to be honest with you. I like the sensation of, shutting off the TV for a while, just picking up the book and having my meal and experiencing that meal while I eat. I think of the people such as myself who, work from their home or in an office, and they just take a salad with them or something, and they don't really have the time to savor it because they have things to do and things to catch up on, or you know, the environment is maybe not the best one. So I would say probably the ones that you get to yourself.
Mm. What I really love about the way you talk about this is also how it ties in with the idea of culinary kinship is not only being something that we create among each other, although that's very important. And I know Yolanda Leyva has spent a lot of time talking about how that creates a connection between people and what is important about that as far as creating kinship. But food also allows us to have a kinship with ourselves, it seems. And what you're describing to me seems like how these moments can be ones where slowing down, being intentional about your relationship with food is what can really make the difference between just eating and having a making a culinary memory. Is that kind of the case?
Yeah, certainly, yeah. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at, yeah, exactly. You phrased it right.
Well, you phrased it right first, so that's sort of how that one worked. But I know that it's also how we create relationships with each other, too. And Tony, I think that's something that emerges within your story and what you wanted to highlight on as well, how the context of food and our sensorial experience of having food in a space can both help us, well, change the context of what we think we're doing, as well as build that kinship with and changing even the relationships that we had already going into it. Do you mind leading us into this?
Yeah, and to sort of start us off where what I wanted to say, we can point our listeners to a clip from an interview with Michelle R. Wood, who is the special events coordinator at the MacGuffin Historical Site. We can go ahead and listen to
her. And that's here in El Paso, right?
Yes, it is. It's actually in downtown. And we can listen to how she talks about how context changes with the introduction of food. So we can go ahead and listen to that.
All right.
When we hear the word museum, most people have this concept that it's kind of this dusty, cold, kind of clinical, lifeless place. But just by introducing food into the equation, very quickly people stopped seeing it that way. And they were suddenly seeing this as something that connected to their daily lives, because we all need to eat to live. Of course, it's even better when the food is really tasty. And it fills not just our stomachs, but our souls.
And basically, the real heart of that clip is that no matter where we are, food has this tendency to bring people together. She mentions the very cold idea of what a museum is, and then all of a sudden becomes very vibrant the moment a dish is introduced. This sort of reminds me of my past.
Well, just real quick on that before we move on, something that, mm-hmm. that makes me think about is introducing food makes it more vibrant. Do you think that's because the introduction of food suddenly brings an element of embodiedness into it in a very different way than when you're just observing something, for instance, in a museum?
I think so. I think the act of being in a way, food is intentional, is inherently vulnerable.
Mm.
I think it's sort of an act that people might feel a little bit embarrassed by, or it's sort of a private experience for a lot of people, or a very intimate experience. So I think bringing that into a public space where people are trying to learn, educate themselves, sort of makes people more open to certain experiences. You know, it's sort of a good icebreaker, I think.
If I may interject something a little bit, because mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that story of Michelle Wood. One of the other things that she says that relates to the idea of the food in the senses is that, and I don't know if this is what Marisa was thinking about, but it's also, there's a moment earlier on in the clip that we heard where she talks about how when you introduce food into a museum, it's a way of tasting the past, sort of, kind of, because we mm-hmm. are cooking with this, you know, recipes that were done 100 years ago, and we're cooking them now in the museum. So we actually are consuming the same flavors, the same aromas, right?
Right.
So it's, the senses here also play the journey of bringing us the past and the present together.
And to sort of actually touch on that, that works perfectly with the story I wanted to bring.
I was just thinking that.
because this sort of reminded me of an experience that I had where I always disliked mole as a dish. And I chalk it up to my youthful palate not being as refined or as open to complex flavors. But what ended up happening is I grew up and I decided that it was sort of up to me to give it a second chance. And I brought in a friend and we decided to go shopping for every ingredient. We were going to make it from scratch. So we got like 19 different ingredients, all the chiles, all the spices, everything we needed. We even bought a blender, like a really cheap one off the shelf, just to like mix all the ingredients, make the salsa. And we made it from scratch. And I think engaging with that sort of historical recipe where, you know, it's a Nahua dish. It's very indigenous. And sort of tasting and being able to differentiate what I had put in, you know, with my hands, sort of in the same way that Yolanda Leyva talks about making it with your hands and feeling the textures and sort of moving around the kitchen and knowing where you're putting everything sort of makes that experience of appreciation much more deep, much more meaningful, and I think significant. And I like it now. I eat it very often. So,
yes, but when are you inviting us over to have some?
Do remind me, because
that is a question.
I'll definitely make some for y'all.
So let me ask you, Tony. Do you think that it was the effect of the, you know, all the investment that you put into all of this, not only the ingredients, but also going out of your way to buy a blender and bringing in a friend to help you and, you know, taking the time to do so, do you think that you probably didn't see that and maybe your palate accommodated to it because of the efforts that you put and then it kind of switched back?
I think labor definitely plays a part in it. I think now it's easier to imagine liking it, if that makes sense, mainly because it's sort of easy for, I guess, a body to reject certain flavors if it's a mystery to us. If it's sort of foreign, then I think there's a bit of a sense of disgust. And I know Carolyn Korsmeyer talks about this in her book, Savoring Disgust, where disgust isn't necessarily just a experience with the body, but also a perceptual experience where we see something foreign that we don't necessarily understand and we're more inclined to not like it. Mm-hmm. So I think working on that dish and actually seeing what it is made it more palatable to me. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I think labor does play a huge role, I think.
And Carolyn Korsmeyer, she's a food philosopher, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And listener, we have our various resources available in the show notes. So if you are curious about following along with some of the things that shaped our thoughts, we encourage you to stop by there and take a look as well. One of the things that made me think about, though, is in relationship with kinship again, because it was your friends who mm-hmm. you were making it with. Right. And though this is part of your culinary heritage, making mole, it was not for your friend, however, correct? But it was something that you worked on together. Do you mind talking about how that changed your relationship either with culinary heritage or culinary kinship?
I think it made us more, one, the labor brought us closer together. But two, I think it also sort of opened their culinary third eye, if you want, because they're Scottish and French. Mm-hmm. So they have no heritage with Mexican or indigenous dishes. And while they've always sort of eaten the traditional or very stereotypical dishes like tacos and beans and rice, I think making something from scratch sort of also gave them an appreciation for complexity of taste. Mm. And in that, we were able to relate to each other a little bit better. We were able to sort of say, like, we have this experience of, you know, reshaping our palates, so to speak.
Excellent. Thank you. And I appreciate your emphasis on labor and effort in this, because I think that's something that is a huge part of what our experience with food is. I mean, that's been our primary drive for as long as there have been human beings, is essentially, how do we get food? And so there is always that push towards it. And so much of our labor throughout human history has been surrounding the idea of acquiring food and eating it and sharing it and what happens out of that. So I think labor is a aspect of our culinary heritages that has become obscured as food gets easier to acquire, right? And so for me, when I think about food, labor is a huge part of that because my family was farmers for a long time. And they had, even though they usually had a job outside of just being a farmer, everyone had a couple acres where they grew food, which then ended up supporting the family, helping everybody through the winter, something that you can share with the neighbors during the good times and celebrate during homecomings and those sorts of events. So when I think about food, the sense that is often activated for me is smell, but it's not smell of food as it's finished. It's smell of food as it's growing. And I think about the smell of the soil and the smell of plants and green things coming into light and warming up in the sun. And since I'm from North Carolina originally, the smell of the dirt where I live is this red clay. And it is often filled with a bunch of decomposing leaves and sticks, and we're close to a lake so that it's bogged down with water, and it's this heavy, thick red clay that always smells something like richness and metal and rot, but from it comes forth all of these beautiful green plants that then start to create a different sort of fragrance in the air of all of the different foods that are emerging, which leads me into thinking about, and by the way, listener and friends here, I am not a French speaker, but this is a French word, so work with me. It is terroir, which is a wine term, actually. It's not a scientific term. It relates to the idea of a certain type of soil or a certain location that grapes come from. It's not something that can be scientifically measured, but becomes part of an idea of not only the environment, but also the culture that shapes how food emerges. And rhetoricians Anna Marjorie Young and Justin Eckstein talk about how this terroir is both general and specific. It's general in that everywhere is a terroir, but it's specific in that each place is its own terroir, unlike anyone else that there is. So the soil then is an intimate part of what makes our food. And it all comes down to the sources of where these things emerge from. But the heritage can be pretty messy when it comes into these aspects. Like, we grew a lot of okra was a big and important one for me. And being from North Carolina, it's a large part of our southern foodways. But it emerged out of southern foodways that had come from encounters of violence, of enslavement, of people being violently displaced and having to find ways to make do. So our culinary heritage is something that we've inherited of messy kinships. And I think what we can take from this going forward, though, is that when we make food and we share it and we grow it, the kinship that we make constantly has the opportunity to remake what our culinary heritages are going to be moving forward. Which is slightly different than where I thought I was going to be heading with this, but I think nonetheless it is true. So we've talked about an aspect of how the senses create this open-mindedness, and I think that that is relevant in the way that the senses are the way that we encounter the world, and we have to be open, or else we're not encountering the world, we're encountering our own ideas of it, I guess.
You've introduced two very interesting concepts of the relationship of heritage and kinship and how mm-hmm. they can change each other, really. Your new understanding or relationship with the earth and rewriting how the soil was used, in particularly in the South, in the history of the United States, when we think about, you know, slavery. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a shifting of the relationship. So I would like to sort of turn it to Fernanda and Tony. to see if you see that sort of interconnection of both heritage and kinship in the stories that you share with us, in which the definitions are sort of changing. And what I mean by changing is that normally when we think of heritage, we think about, you know, the skills, the how to do something that we inherit. And kinship, it deals with issues of relationships or connections. But in your stories and your experiences, and the things that we discussed over the course of the semester in our class, have those concepts changed for you a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because we've observed this topic so closely throughout the course, I think that I can now come to terms with the definition of what heritage means to me, which is I don't want to carry the expectancies that others have for me. Wherever I feel like I belong, that is my heritage. Those are my roots. I don't necessarily have to carry the responsibility of knowing a culture that where I have not been around for a very long time. And I think a lot of us have such a big struggle dealing with that sort of disappointment, even when we are trying to recreate that cultural heritage in some way in front of our families or friends that expect us to still have it. You know, we somehow get trapped into it and we're still not doing the job that they expect us to do with it. We get called out for it often, and it's not pleasant, but it's something that I think we just have to kind of learn how to separate ourselves from, and the negativity that comes with it, and just create whatever it is that heritage means to us and what those things are and what those foods are and who those people are. It's about recreating entirely.
And I think that the idea of, I see in this notion of recreating, where for me, kinship comes in, culinary kinship comes in, because we're recreating different kinds of relationships, right? It's kind of bonds. How about you, Tony?
I would say that there's a sort of, at least for me, a new kind of pushback. When creating sort of these relationships, for example, my friend can go ahead and do it in their own version of mole that suits their palate. And
ooh, mole with haggis.
Try it first. Let me know how it goes.
Exactly. And I think, like Fernando was saying, is that, like, you know, we can create our own definitions. I also think that there's a relationship that we have with time, where I think the old definition is we got to think about the past constantly. Whereas now, for me, it's more about who it's up to right now. And I feel like creating those kinships is more of a forward, more progressive way of looking at things. We're creating the heritage, and that heritage can always evolve and with sort of snowballing and moving forward, as opposed to, you know, always sticking with the past and trying to preserve the past in that way.
This reminds me of David Sutton, a cultural anthropologist, who talks about perspective memory, mm-hmm. where basically what it means is that we create something in the now for the future. Mm. Which is sort of echoes what you're saying, that we need to think about time as to what are we doing now,
right,
to set pathways for different kinds of heritage that people coming, you know, years from now mm-hmm. can claim to.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Heritage not being something that's static, but is always in the process of becoming and it being made. And the past always being something that is constantly moving forward. So I think it's... I appreciate that temporal view of how we think about our relationship between heritage and kinship as being something which is in conversation and constantly moving forward. Thank you all. Yeah. I feel like we've had a very satisfying conversation, and now I'm still thinking about fajitas, so I think I will go and have a very satisfying meal afterwards. But as we're closing, are there any final thoughts? Fernanda, I think you had something you wanted us to remember.
Yes, that was every meal that you consume in your lifetime will fuel your body, but only a few of those will fuel your soul.
I'm going to have to ask one question to all three of you, because Fernanda set it up so beautifully. Mm-hmm. Would you mind sharing what is one of those foods that fill your soul?
Oh.
If you want, I can start.
Yes.
I think at this point, anybody who's been following through a Positive Food Voices will probably already know what I'm going to say. And that's chilaquiles. That's the food that makes me feel closer to my mother than any other food. I always said that when I eat it, when I smell them, when all the senses that we're talking about, it's my mother's embrace that I'm feeling.
It's wonderful. I think for me would be, it's not necessarily a food, and you know, you guys know this about me. I growing up with my grandma, she would basically make coffee a certain way. And I told you all, you know, like she would use a specific spoon, a specific mug. And so from there, I kind of like measured, you know, what she would put in her coffee. She would have instant coffee. She never had a coffee pot to make that in. And so I grew up believing that there was no need for one ever. And so up to this day, I still don't. And I doubt that I ever will. But I think that it was, you know, seeing her, just seeing her, I mean, make it just so precisely every morning, the same thing. And her giving it to me, I think that caused my addiction to coffee. But I think that that's something that really opened up my kinship with, I mean, people, the environment around, you know, that specific, I'm not going to call it dish because it's not a dish, but just coffee. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I think for me, it has to be tamales. The season for it is coming up at the time of recording, so I'm getting very excited. But it as a dish sort of means just family to me, means sort of my Chicano heritage, but it also is something to look forward to at the end of the year, because it's one of those dishes that you don't make every day. You don't make it every month or even every week. So the fact that it's usually only done at a certain time of year, and this could be, for me, it's tamales. It could be a different dish for anyone. I think those are very, very special dishes that I think bring people together. So I'm looking forward to eating quite a few in the next coming month.
Yes, absolutely. For me, I'm going to sidestep it a little bit. It's not necessarily a dish, but being from Las Cruces, the addition of green chili to almost literally everything. Yes. I have yet to find anything it does not improve. But for me, it has just a very unique flavor, which connects me to this place, which is not where I was born, but where I've managed to tangle my roots and where I'm really happy to be. So green chili on ice cream and apple dumplings, on your pizza, in a sandwich, however you want it, green chili. Yes.
Sounds perfect. So once again, thank you. I would like to thank both, the three, I should say, of our guests today, co-presenters, I should say, my students, Marisa, Fernanda, and Tony, for their insights on food and the senses and its relationship to culinary heritage and kinship. With this, I would like to invite our audience who are listening to think about their food stories, think about your food stories, and think about what kinship, what relationships they entangle. Think about the heritage that it carries, and the possibilities that it can offer to have new forms of kinships. With that, we'll say thank you. Have a wonderful night, day, morning, whenever you listen to this. El Paso Food Voices was created by Meredith E. Abarca, professor of food studies and literature at the University of Texas at El Paso. Produced by Adrian Mesa from UTEP's Creative Studios. To learn more about how food practices, memories, and stories shape a city's history, culture, and its character, please visit us at El Paso Food Voices. Thank you.